Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato and I'm CEO and President of Ladenburg Thalmann Asset Management. Welcome to another weekly update on the U.S. economy, the equity market, the bond market, and the coronavirus. As we continue through the dog days of summer, it's nice that we're still enjoying the warmth and long days, although they are getting shorter. My favorite day of the year is the summer solstice, and my second favorite day is the winter solstice because every day after that gets a little bit brighter. And if we're still having these weekly calls by the winter solstice, that would not be great. I'm hoping we can go back to monthly because things have calmed down. But as of now, that's not the case. So hopefully you're still enjoying the warm summer days and looking forward to a safe and healthy fall. Let's hope that happens. As the latest of the virus goes, we're now over 23 million people, almost 23 million people impacted worldwide. Over almost 800,000 deaths globally. This week, total active cases stands at 6.5 million. There's been roughly 16 million cases with an outcome, and of those, 15 million have recovered with, like I mentioned, about 800,000 that have passed away. One key point that we continue to notice is the fatality rate continues to come down. When we began these calls months back, the fatality rate on a weekly basis was just about 6%. Now it's down to 3.63%, and the number of folks who are critically ill around the globe is down to 60,000. So that's a nice improvement from where we've been. In the United States, from the height of the new case situation, remember we had that pretty significant spike, what we've seen is we are now down 36% from the July 24th high. Roughly 78,000 cases that day versus 44,000 just yesterday. The death rate, which was at low at one point, around 550 to 700 deaths per day in the United States, did spike up to about 1,100 to 1,200 a day, but that's now come back down to about 1,000 a day. So we have seen a bit of an improvement along the lines of, new cases. It's not showing through in the death rate yet in the United States, but it's beginning to. So very optimistic around what's happening, that the second wave we were so worried about seems to be broken again. And as of now, the reality is we are slowly getting control of this again. It's interesting, for all the concerns about masks and whether or not they're effective or not, when you look at the Sun Belt states, which originally did not have a mask mandate in many of the places, when they installed a significant mask mandate, where that nearly 80% of all Sun Belt states, 80% of all Sun Belt states, now require a mask in public, have bent the curve from roughly 350 cases per day per million people back down to 200 cases per day per million people. Now, they're not down at the 100 range per day for the country, and certainly not where the New York, New Jersey area is at 50, but a significant improvement simply by wearing masks. And what we do know now is that 80% of the country is effectively wearing masks, and it's working. We are being smarter about our distancing, and you're seeing it come through in the changing of the new case count. Not yet showing through as we'd like in the fatality rate, but we would expect that to be a lagging indicator and improve. When you look at us versus other countries, we're still markedly higher than everyone else, but truth be told, some of the other countries are having a bit of a problem. France has gone from just a few hundred cases a day to about 500 to 1,000 a day, depending on the day. Spain has gone from just a few hundred a day to anywhere as much as 8,000 or 9,000 a day. They've had some really tough days, better recently, thankfully. Japan, a bit of a spike, something bears watching, and even Germany, from almost zero to a few thousand a day. So every country is still trying to figure out the right way to manage this as we go through this process of continuing the reopening, and then more importantly, what we do at schools. You know, schools is in the headline right now and how we go about that process. I would say the biggest problems globally are really not the United States right now. We are improving pretty rapidly. Where the issue is globally is India, up to 60,000 to 70,000 new cases a day and continuing to go higher. Mexico has come up to about 6,000 to 7,000 a day. They had begun to improve, but they're having a bit of a tough time again. In Brazil, 50,000 to 60,000 a day. And for the United States, we're probably not going to be the number one country in that terrible slot of total cases soon, because more than likely be passed by Brazil and by India. They're a bigger population, so it stands to reason, but certainly they've got work ahead of them to get this thing under control. One of the recent studies from J.P. Morgan noted that to build a herd immunity, we need at least 10% of the population to have antibodies. And when studies have been done around the globe, there's only a handful of places, actually just a few, that have antibodies above 10%. New York City leads the way with roughly 21% of the folks being tested showing antibodies. So there is a very much a herd immunity in New York City per traditional statistics. After that, somewhere like Gangert, Germany, or more importantly, New York State falls in that. For me, I live in the New Jersey, New York area. England, but more specifically London, is above 10%, and the rest of the globe is below that. So we're not quite yet building that herd immunity. It's kind of a double-edged sword. On one hand, we're doing a good job of keeping our daily case rate low, but at the other hand, we're not building a herd immunity, so we're going to maybe kind of battle two masters at once, trying to keep people from passing away by limiting the infection. But if more people got infected and didn't pass away, we'd have a herd immunity, which would eliminate the infection. So it's one of these kind of unusual moments as we go through this virus. I would note that of the more than 170,000 folks that have passed away, the vast majority still stands to be in places like nursing homes. When you look at Connecticut, who recently paid for an independent study of the folks that have passed away, of their roughly 4,500 people that passed away in Connecticut, 3,000 were in nursing homes. Looked at a different way, when you look at New Jersey, for example, with really nearly 200,000 cases and over 16,000 people have passed away, that pales in comparison to California with over 600,000 cases, but just about 10,000 people have passed away. So while New York and New Jersey and Connecticut didn't do the best job of managing nursing homes, what we did find out is their mistake has led the rest of the country to be very smart about as we reopen protecting the most vulnerable. And even looked at a different standpoint, deaths per million. In New Jersey, per million people, there were roughly 1,800 deaths. In New York, 1,700. Versus Texas, per 1 million people at 311, or California at 270. So when we look at this disease, as we learn more about it, it's still very much about protecting the folks who are most vulnerable. And as we open up schools, what's really being found out here is whether it's us or Europe, it's a bit of a challenge. New cases are going up in Europe. And yet in Europe, there's a strong commitment to opening schools. Even in the UK, where they had a bit of a pushback about opening up schools from the teachers' union, they finally agreed on the metrics around opening it up. And based on those metrics, they've had good success at actually opening it up. Places like Sweden, where they never shut down, or Germany as they're going through this process, or France, which is actually making it mandatory to go to in-person school, are all opening, but doing it with very strict guidelines. Whether it's mask wearing, whether it's smaller classroom sizes, keeping a single teacher involved rather than multiple teachers, less rotation in the schools, and some mix of keeping the kids engaged in school, but also some external learning as well. So as we, like them, go through this process, it's a learning phase. In the United States, today's headlines are a bit troubling in that when we look at today's headlines, places like Michigan State, which has decided to move their entire academic fall back to online and not have the kids come to campus. Notre Dame, which is pushing everything online at least for a few weeks here and limiting movement on campus, may send the kids home. Ironically, Ithaca College, which is not far from Cornell, is shifted to remote learning while Cornell is in person. So there is a bit of a case-by-case basis. My own children live in New Jersey, and initially we were going to be part-time in school, 4 days a week, half day in school and half day at home, and that's really been pushed back to online. So the reason why this is relevant is obviously we want to protect children and, more importantly, the people that they can bring it home to, because of all the cases in Europe to date, less than 5% are under the age of 15. So we know that it's still not very impactful to younger people. 94% of the deaths in the United States are people over the age of 55 years old. Our younger population is tiny. You're talking single-digit numbers of folks that have passed away, but there is belief that they can bring this disease home and infect whether it's a teacher or somebody at their house. So this process of opening up is critical. We watch Louisiana and Georgia and Tennessee open up and then have to shut back down in certain locations because of a concern of a spike in virus. And this is critical because, one, we're seeing the academic standards for children learning from home versus school being quite different. A report from the federal government has indicated that children are struggling to learn from home in this new environment. Socially, what social impact does it have? And then a recent study of adults found that we have now tripled in the number of people thinking about suicide in the last 30 days or using more drugs or alcohol to alleviate the stress of the virus. So the unintended consequences can be profound. And for that reason, we continue to believe we're going to open up the economy. We basically don't have much choice for the reasons, not just the economics, but the other unintended consequences. But can we do it in a safe and effective manner? And truth be told, when we look at the improvement in places like California, which have had 1,000 more people leave their ICU beds in the last week, with 25% occupancy available in California, and their new case rate coming down quite a bit. Arizona, when it was really tough in Arizona in the last month, where they were having over 5,000 new cases a day, are back down to roughly 600 cases a day, so a vast improvement. 1,300 person drop in hospitalizations, and their overall ICU is back to averages of where they were pre the spike. Florida has cut their new case rate in half, from 12,000 a day to 6,000 a day. The death rate from 184 to 84 per day. And their ICU occupancy back nearly 20%, and another 1,000 people coming out of the ICU. And similar for Texas, which has seen their infection rate fall down to 11% from 23. 500 more beds available. And in fact, we saw another 1,000 people come out of the hospital in Texas as well. So we're watching this process play out where we can continue to open up the U.S. economy. We can manage this process, but doing so in a very smart and mindful way. And ironically, going back to where I started the call, our infection levels are interesting in that as we get to that herd immunity above 10%, the infection levels are something that's being monitored pretty closely. And oddly enough, because of the efforts made recently, our highest days of infection on average per 7 days in every single state is now lower in every single state, meaning we have had other periods of time since it began, in some cases a 20, 30, 40, 50% drop in the infection level. So to put numbers behind it, in the state of Georgia, for example, for the average of 1 million people on a 7-day moving average, there were 400 people infected per day. Now that number is down to 275. So we're seeing our ability to manage the new case infection improve, but certainly there are reasons to be concerned about, are we going to build a herd immunity? Can we protect children and adults? And how do we do that smartly with opening up the economy? And that's squarely where we are. And that when we think about the economics behind our economy right now, so much is predicated on our ability to open up our economy and, in fact, keep people safe. I think that is the narrative that we can't shy away from. However, when we start thinking about economics and how things are going, well, first let's start off with a headline that I think got skipped, and I'm not really sure why. Part of the reason we've been able to recover on the S&P 500, and I haven't gotten to it yet, but, you know, good news here. We have now recovered all that we lost this year. The S&P 500 is now up on the year. Now, it's doing so on a bit of hope and prayer. Valuations on company, how much their price is versus how much they earn, are not great, meaning you're not earning enough money to support valuation. The average company earnings for the second quarter were down just about 10%. Now, that's better than the negative 30 we expected. We saw companies like Target last night post blowout earnings, 195% increase in online sales. Home Depot had the best quarter in the last 20 years, $35 billion of new revenue. So there were certain sectors of the economy and specific companies that were COVID impacted to the positive. Technology, healthcare, things that we need. As we canceled our vacations, we spent it on homes. Consumer spending right now is above the level before the pandemic. We are a strong consumer right now, and it's because the federal government came in and gave folks money and gave small businesses the opportunity to survive. We had nearly 25% of our businesses shuttered permanently back in April. Believe it or not, we're now only down to 6. They've decided to reopen. They have enough money to stand open. And in fact, small business optimism is up and believe they have another 6 months of funding to sustain through the end of the year before they would have to claim bankruptcy. Our expectations were that we would get a much higher level of bankruptcy for larger and smaller companies, and so far that's not really happening. And it's to the credit of the federal government and the Federal Reserve, with spending nearly $4 trillion so far, with the potential to spend $8 trillion more. That's a lot of money. I really hope it doesn't get that far. It's going to take years for us to pay that back. But so far, it's doing what it intended to do when you see it in consumer spending. As of late, there's a concern that that money's going away. But truth be told, the president, even though the Congress and Senate can't agree right now, the president signed an executive order allowing states to pay more money and charge the federal government for it. And in fact, Arizona, Iowa, Louisiana, New Mexico, Colorado, Missouri, and Utah have all making efforts to pay an additional $300 on top of state unemployment aid to support those folks who are out of work. So that building that bridge onto the other side of this virus is still working and still moving forward. And I think it's exciting that we're able to find some stopgaps in that, because it's critical that the consumers survive all of this. That is what drives us. That's what we need to support us. And without that, we're going to have a very difficult time being able to really break out of this recession, because the recession really is all about the strength of the U.S. consumer and can we get back to where we were. Now, it's not an overnight scenario. There's no golden lever to turn the economy back on. A negative 9% drawdown in the second quarter is not going to be eliminated just overnight. But certainly having a stronger third quarter, which we're on the pace for right now, because of the strength of the consumer, leads us to believe that we can at least sustain these highs. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the market has come very far, very fast. And for that reason, I think we got to have some concerns about how high the stock market has gone without support of earnings. However, the stock market is a forecasting mechanism. It's looking 12 to 18 months out, and it's expecting that we're going to have a virus, or excuse me, an antivirus, or a vaccine, or a therapeutic. So I think that's a very powerful statement. So why don't we switch gears to that? We know that the economy is doing well, and I'll touch on that in just a minute. But before that, let's just give a quick update on the antiviruses and the vaccines, because it's always fun to talk a bit about that. I know it's of great interest to many of the listeners. Well, as of right now, there's been some interesting points made by the federal government that they don't believe it's necessary to have a vaccine that's perfect. We don't need to have something that's going to be 100% perfect. And the reason why is if we can get something that is 50% effective or 60% effective, Dr. Stephen Hahn and Dr. Carlos Del Rio, Dr. Rio from Emory University and Dr. Hahn from the Food and Drug Administration, both admitted that a 40 to 60% effective vaccine would be more than enough of what we need. No different than the flu, by the way. The annual flu vaccine is only 40 to 60% effective. And why that's so important is because if we can simply help less people get sick, then the virus would go away on its own by being eliminated through lack of transmission, like most other viruses. However, if that doesn't happen, you know, what vaccine can come to market right now that can help us get through this? Well, China is definitely having one heck of a lead on us. Right now, CanSino Biologics is far ahead and about to get approval by the Chinese government to begin mass distribution by the fall. They're in phase 3 trials and have had excellent results from it, and are actually beginning to partner with other countries in the world. China has made a decision to use this company to be able to help places like Pakistan, the Philippines, and Indonesia with the virus. Even Russia, partnering with Russia as a second vaccine for them, to try and create some goodwill, considering their, let's be honest, I guess there's some countries that think that they're at fault for this, and they're trying to create goodwill with those countries that are under immense pressure or immense economic issues for that, and they're reaching out with the vaccine they've created. A second one they have is called Sinopharm. They've structured a deal to work with a number of Middle Eastern countries like Saudi Arabia, and decided to charge $144 a dose for their vaccine, which is very inexpensive. It's a two-shot vaccine, considering how much of an impact it could have. They have another company called Sinovac, which is actually partnering with Indonesia to begin a trial of 1,600 people, moving along fairly aggressively. On more American-based companies, American English, Oxford University is partnered with Australia to begin a free-of-charge testing program there and offer that drug when it's available. Remember, they're in a 50,000-person study right now. When that drug is going to be available, should be probably before year-end, but we'll get the results of that study now, but they're now partnered with Australia as well. Pfizer and BioNTech, that's a very American-based one, very popular, very exciting. Now the Yale School of Medicine has also decided to partner with them to do their own study of the effectiveness. That would be a second independent study. Remember, Pfizer is doing a 30,000-person study right now. Johnson & Johnson's partnered with Brazil to do a 6,000-person study. And Novavax is partnered with South Africa to do a 2,600-person study supported by the Gates Foundation. I think it's amazing the way this really is a global effort and using a variety of different countries to get us to a place where maybe we're able to solve this much faster by having everyone chip in. Vaxart is a different type of therapeutic plasma-based that is in a pill form. Most of these are shots that you got to get in a hospital or a doctor's office. However, Vaxart is creating a pill that can be table ready, meaning it doesn't have to be refrigerated. That's really exciting that they'll have one that's in phase 2 trials that you just maybe will go to a drugstore, pick it up, and get better. Convalescent plasma, it continues to be very exciting. It's the second approved drug out there that we can use to treat this. And another $750,000 has been dedicated to be able to scale up convalescent plasma via Plasma Technologies LLC. So supporting, okay, when people get sick, it's a way to get them better. And probably the most exciting news of the week was Regeneron. Remember, I've talked about Regeneron and Eli Lilly as the keys to getting out of this. These are therapeutics that get you better. Regeneron has decided to partner with Roche, arguably one of the biggest and best pharmaceutical companies in the world. Right now, Regeneron has 1.3 million doses of their vaccine. They can quadruple it with Roche's help and create 4 to 8 million vials alone. They believe that their therapeutic will actually get people better in 24 to 48 hours and give them the opportunity to create not only a therapeutic or a prophylactic, but give it to people who aren't sick that are in critical areas that could be affected by this. So I think that's very interesting that it may work to a degree like a vaccine, but certainly to get people better, which then keeps the pressure off our hospitals, then allows us to reopen, and as people get sick, we have a way to get them better, which is a critical component of this. That's why I'm so excited about a therapeutic, which could come to market much sooner than a vaccine. We're expecting results from Regeneron and Eli Lilly by the end of this month, if not early September. Kind of exciting news. And one other vaccine I'll mention, or this is a therapeutic as well, there's a brand new company called Mesoblast. We haven't heard much from these guys, and we actually know them fairly well here at Ladenburg. Well, they take a totally different approach. They use medicinal signaling cells, or SMCs. It's a very different type of approach that tries to teach your body not only to heal itself, but goes in and has a two-pronged approach. Not only does it stop what's called a cyclotine storm, or the damage being done to lungs, it actually helps heal the holes in the lungs created by the virus. In a study done by Mount Sinai, they studied a dozen severely ill patients. 83 of those patients survived. That's a pretty significant number. A separate study done of 13 critically ill patients by The Lancet had, of the 13, 85% survival rate of those as well. So very high survival rate, but also repairing of lungs. Now, this is a completely different approach. They believe this approach can work for over 900 different human infections. It is brand new, it's cutting edge, and it's just getting going. However, it does seem like it has created a very positive response. So it's a completely new idea, and I only mention it because it sounds exciting, and I think we're much more excited about what's already in place and being built. And they're not even in phase one trial, but they're in phase one trial right now. They're on their way to phase two. Let me rephrase that. They've been through phase one. They're phase two, they're using small human studies, but they do not have a full-blown phase two trial yet, nor a phase three trial yet. So there's a ways to go there. However, you lump all this together and the market is up this high because of the hope around a vaccine or a therapeutic, the reality of getting control of the virus again in the United States, the hope that going back to school is not going to create a third wave, or at least a second wave in certain areas. And so far, with many schools being open since mid to late July, I think about Georgia, and Georgia has had places that have had to shut down, but certainly not statewide. And then going through this process into September, we're going to know pretty soon how we are going to be able to manage this opening up process. It's not to think that the economy is going full bore in, because it's not. In New York City, I'd say the restaurants are making 25 to 50% of what they traditionally make. It's very hard to make money in a small corral on a street to be able to go outside and participate in eating outside, or certainly not going to a bar. But there is revenue being generated. When I mentioned retail sales area, that's a very exciting number, whether it's Home Depot or Lowe's or Target. Those are numbers that were somewhat unexpected just a few months back. So we're seeing the effects put in place actually play out. 9 of 13 categories in retail sales increased. And as I mentioned earlier, we're now making more in retail sales than we did, or spending more than we did pre-pandemic. It's in different categories, but certainly we are spending it. When you look at other economic data like initial jobless claims, they came in at 963 claims last week. That's the best number of the entire pandemic. It's still worse than the worst number of the 2008 recession. that number 660,000 versus this number at 963,000. But it shows another 225,000 person improvement and continued success there. The unemployment market is critical. We need to get people back to work. And as we do that, the pain in the overall economy will lessen, and watching the unemployment market is critical. As I mentioned earlier, earnings growth has come in fairly good. Not as bad as expected, let's put it that way. We thought we'd see as much as 30% declines, and in fact, it's only down really right now about 8% earnings growth and 10% sales growth. So because some of the companies were very successful, think about technology and healthcare, it helped make up for so many companies that failed so poorly, like industrials, banks, and energy. Consumer confidence continues to hang in there. We had another consumer confidence print of a 72.8, which is up from the prior month of 72.5. Now, you'd like to see that number closer to 90, but certainly it shows that the consumer is not giving up, and as of now, still confident the economy is reopening. The brightest spot of the week was the housing market. The U.S. housing market came in fantastic. When new home construction came in at up 22% for the month of July, with 1.5 million homes expected to be built, 18% improvement in building permits, or another 1.5 million. New homes, when you think of all the components of them, the mortgages, the lumber, the people building it, it could be as much as 10% of our GDP. So it's quite significant. So when you think about the fact that homes have held up in value and the reality that we're seeing new homes being built, it is a great sign of health in the U.S. economy. And it's partially because when you think about this situation versus the last time, as we've mentioned before, the banks are in excellent shape this time around. They're able to lend money. They're able to create positive environments. They're able to spur growth. And for that reason, we're optimistic much more so than the 2008 scenario, where this is an event-driven recession. The shortest recession of your lifetime. One of the worst in velocity, straight down and now straight up. But however, we're coming out of this recession and potentially to grow fairly rapidly if we get help from the medical community and continued help from the federal government. What it does mean, though, is the stock market and the bond market are not inexpensive. Bond yields are some of the lowest in your lifetime. Maybe in the last week you noticed how bond yields went up a little bit, and you lost money in bonds this past week. And that's because yields are so low and more than likely going to grind higher with so much excess money being printed in the world. And the stock market, when you look at valuations, stocks are trading at an over 45% premium to where they normally trade at. That's a very high number. It's like going to the store and having to buy vegetables for 45% more than what you normally do. More than likely, you're not going to buy a lot of vegetables. Same thing in the stock market. There's a handful of companies that offer some value, but those are companies that have struggled during COVID. Companies that are doing very well are not inexpensive. So while I'm happy the stock market has recovered, the stock market's not inexpensive. The bond market, as I mentioned, is also not expensive. So the key here is be conservative with your assets. Participate in these markets. Make sure you're invested, but don't get overly exuberant thinking we're about to begin the next bull market simply because there's still a major political election coming, obviously. Still unknowns about the virus and whether how we're going to get out of this thing. We're doing a good job managing it as of late, but certainly when you think about how we end this and go back to normal, we're not there yet. And while the Federal Reserve has helped out get us to this point, they can't do that indefinitely. So I think it's interesting to be optimistic about the economy. And certainly the markets have recovered all that we've lost. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves and think things are all roses from here forward, because they're just not. Year to date, the S&P now is up 6% on the year. It's about 0.25% above its all-time high. So we're at an all-time high as of this recording. However, on an equally weighted basis, we're still down 3.5% on the year, and there's still over 350 names in the S&P 500 that are actually down, not up. So that's a critical component to this. Think of it differently. If you look at the energy sector, for example, the energy sector, by and large, is still down over 30% on the year. The banking sector, by and large, still down over 20% on the year. Real estate, still down nearly 10% on the year. Industrials, 10% on the year. Technology's up over 25, and consumer discretionary is up over 22. Communications are up over about 10, but that's about it. It's a very narrow market with the top 10 stocks leading the way and creating the bulk of the return for everybody. So I think it's exciting we got to where we are, but we need to be mindful about where we go from here, especially watching how schools reopen, our progress on the vaccine, And more, and ultimately, as we change our mind away from the vaccine, as we get closer to ending it, because of a, away from the virus, forgive me, as we change our mind less about the virus, simply managing it and living through it, and more about what's happening for the overall economy and now the election. The election really is an interesting time. What the market wants is an uncontested election. It wants us to see the scenario where someone gets elected, uncontested, and we move on as a country. Believe it or not, average returns in election years are over 9.5%. If, in fact, we get a vaccine and we get an uncontested election and the economy starts to open again, folks, we're going to end the year right at 10% plus on the S&P 500. Can you imagine that? Being down from over 35% to being plus 10%. You're talking one massive swing in total return. But the reason why that needs to happen is not only do we need success on the vaccine front, but we also need success on the political front and support of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy. So for that reason, I think we're going to have lots of volatility between here and there. This election seems like it's going to be pretty tumultuous. There's a lot of passion right now, maybe more so than ever. I think we say that in every election. But certainly this one's no different than the others. And when you talk about impact of the two different presidents, what's their tax policy going to be? That will affect the market long term. What's their spending policy going to be? And do they have a unified government? Believe it or not, the market tends to like governments that are split. So there's not too many decisions made one significant way or the other. So Democratic House and Senate and the president from either party generally tends to be the best overall market. But it depends on the time period and how you look at the data, to be honest with you. What the market wants is stability. It doesn't want the unknown. And that's what we're hoping to get out of the next election. So you wrap it all up and you say we've had, again, further success from the medical front. Better economic data, continued support by the federal government, and looks like the House and Senate may get together. If they don't, the president seems to have done enough to continue some support here. Overall, you know, some euphoria about the market being at an all-time high, but concern about how much we're going to earn from here, and the bond market not being inexpensive. But certainly, if you're in the right types of investment, steering away from the higher risk asset class, you should be just fine to navigate these waves of volatility as we get them going into the fall. Remember, September is the worst month of the year historically for the stock market. And for that reason, we expect volatility from news about the virus, the election, the economy, and actions by the federal government. So hang in there. We'll continue these calls. Hopefully they're helpful for you. If you have any questions or concerns, feel free to reach out to us. We will gladly answer any questions that you might have. If you reach out to your financial advisor, and they'll contact us and try and get you whatever it is you'd like to learn more about. Thank you for your time today. Be safe. Enjoy the warm summer days, and hope to talk to you all real soon. Take care.